Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm fine, David. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. You just got back from a road trip through Ireland talking about Thomas Jefferson and all kinds of things, so you're recovering with a cup of tea. I am keeping up the standard here for us with a glass of whiskey from the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society that you've kindly provided for me. You're a member, I guess, of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society. I've been there a couple times, and they have good things. So I'm quite enjoying this, and you're recovering with your cup of tea. All right, two topics today. One is the firing of FBI Director James Comey last Tuesday. We'll talk about that and talk about the historical precedents for that, including the Saturday Night Massacre. And topic two, the passage in the House of the American Health Care Act, ACA, which is a really awful acronym, last Thursday, the day we recorded our last episode.
So Thursday
previous. Yes, exactly. With all time is passing here in weird ways. So we'll talk about that. So our first topic, the firing of James Comey. Frank, you want to, I think most people listening to this have been paying attention to that, but do you want to sort of summarize what's happened as far as we understand what's happened in the past week?
Sure, happy to. With the proviso, of course, that it is Sunday afternoon at 4:30 here in Edinburgh, and goodness knows how this story will change before while we're recording this.
Yes.
Because if there's one thing that happened this week, it was that events moved incredibly quickly. Yes. In fact, as we were planning this episode, we were talking about what to do, and the passage of the Health Care Act, which we'll get to in a few minutes, seemed like it happened a year ago.
Or the testimony of Sally Yates, and all these are the kinds of things that have happened within, you know, relatively within the past week.
So events are happening very, very quickly. but among them, and one of the more noteworthy events in the short but busy history of the Trump administration, was the firing of the CIA director,
FBI
James
director.
FBI director, sorry, excuse me, the FBI director, James Comey, on Tuesday. So he was fired on Tuesday of last week. His firing was very interesting in a lot of ways. And so Director Comey was in Los Angeles at the time, speaking to agents in the Los Angeles field office of the FBI, when a news report appeared on television saying, informing him that he was fired. Comey believed that it was actually a prank being played on him by the agents in the local field office, because he thought it was unbelievable. It was an odd way to inform the director that he'd been fired, certainly. And Comey's firing was a long time coming, and so it does bear some explanation. James Comey, who had been appointed to a 10-year term, was, of course, played a key role in the election last fall, not least because we now know the FBI was conducting dual-track investigations, one of Hillary Clinton and her email server, and the other of the links between elements of the Trump campaign and foreign governments, notably Russia.
And one of which was in the news all the time, and the other one wasn't.
Yes, and that's crucial. As we know, 11 days before the election, Director Comey reported that the FBI was opening a further line of investigation of Hillary Clinton and her email, connected to emails that were found on the laptop of Anthony Weiner.
Yeah.
The infamous New York former congressman who'd been involved in a sexting scandal. And so this was a mess.
Whose wife was one of Huma Abedin was one of Hillary's supporters and counselors.
One of her key aides, yeah. Her closest aide, in fact.
If you couldn't write this in a novel and get it and say anyone, this was remotely plausible as a plot device.
But no, anyway, okay, absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, we don't need to worry too much about that, except insofar as it was widely believed by many Democrats and others that Comey's intervention announcing this investigation 11 days before the vote last November influenced the outcome of the election. And Congress has been looking into this matter as well as the investigation into the Trump campaign that the FBI has been conducting. As a consequence of all of that, last week Comey testified before Congress and spoke to the press, and among other things expressed not quite regret, but went through his thought process in trying to justify himself. We had a paradox here, and I think this did influence Trump's decision to fire Comey, in that Democrats and liberals for months have been calling for Comey to be sacked. And certainly I think there was an expectation that if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, that Comey would have been removed from office. So we fast forward to Tuesday of the past week, and President Trump, apparently angry at some of the things Comey had said to Congress the week before, decided to fire him. The justification, the original justification for sacking Comey was that it was his investigation of Hillary Clinton and the improper conduct of that investigation, despite the fact that Trump had praised that investigation during the campaign.
I don't think anybody bought that when that came out.
But that was the justification that Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Huckabee had to go out and defend. And they did so with risible results, frankly. And if you saw Saturday Night Live last night, you know that they were widely derided for that. And over the next 2 to 3 days, all these stories collapsed. And not least because Donald Trump kept talking.
He went on Lester Holt and basically said, no, I've been planning to fire him for a very long time. And I was firing him because of his investigations into Russia. So he basically just sort of threw everybody in the White House under the bus.
And completely undermined both the timeline and the justification that they... I won't say they carefully crafted it. Nothing was carefully crafted about this. But the one they kind of pieced together in the aftermath of Comey's firing, they cobbled together this jury-rigged explanation that it was all about their being so upset.
Concerned for Hillary's welfare.
Yeah, which was just crazy. Mm-hmm. And then over the next 2 or 3 days, that fell apart. Yeah. And now we're left with the fact that Trump, I think, spoke truth and said, look, I fired him over the Russia investigation. Yeah. I fully intended to do it. And so this has prompted lots of commentary and lots of people on the left and the right, it should be said, to say we have a constitutional crisis in the making. Why are they making that case, David?
So I think part of it is, you know, the FBI, for the Justice Department generally, and the FBI, you know, even if they are part of the executive branch and are responsible to the president, the president can fire people in the executive branch as he feels so inclined. The sense that the Justice Department and the FBI in particular should be independent of political maneuverings, and they should be sort of apolitical in their orientation, you know. And so I think part of the reason why the FBI director has a longer term than the president, than Congress, than senators, than basically anybody except for federal judges, the reason why he has a 10-year term is in part to guarantee, or at least to, maybe not guarantee, at least to isolate or insulate the FBI director from sort of the political machinations, the day-to-day, you know, give and take. And the fact that he's, you know, obviously actively involved in an investigation of the president firing him seems to, you know, suggest that he is engaging in a, you know, effort to, you know, sidetrack that investigation, if not kill it entirely.
Was it legal for him to fire this Director Comey?
I think it's entirely, well, okay, I think the so there's been one example of an FBI director fired previously. Bill Clinton fired an FBI director after very detailed investigations by Congress, and there was some money being sort of government funds being used for private reasons, and so he was fired then.
There was also one guy who was removed in the very, very early history of the agency before J. Edgar Hoover,
which is, you know,
ancient history.
Right. So, I mean, I think, does he have the legal power to remove him? Yes. But at the same time, the choice of removing him when he's under investigation seems like he is intending to, you know, subvert justice or impede an investigation, which that would be illegal. So the firing isn't illegal, but the, you know, impeding justice would be. That would be the distinction I would draw between those two things.
So is it...
Now, the latter is more difficult to prove, right? I think the latter is requires some, you know, the nuance rather than, you know, whether it's legal to or not.
Well, if there's one thing we know is an adjective that would describe the Trump administration, it's nuance. but... Leaving us, well, I think the question of legality is important, but then there's also the question of whether it was politic to do.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah.
Which is a different question, although it is related. So could you, the political reaction to this has been quite interesting. I mean, a lot of people have been saying it's a constitutional crisis, and they immediately went to the immediate historic antecedent that people are going to is Watergate, but particularly the Saturday Night Massacre.
So the Saturday, yeah, so the analogy everyone's drawing, and it's a, you know, I think a fairly good analogy, although there's, like all analogies, there are limits to it, is to the Saturday Night Massacre in October of 1973. So the background to this is that at the behest of Congress, Richard Nixon's Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, had appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the Watergate break-in, a man by the name of Archibald Cox. Archibald Cox is investigating Watergate, but then he starts to sort of follow the case beyond the specifics of the break-in, and it's kind of these links to the White House. And when knowledge that Richard Nixon had been taping conversations in the White House comes to the fore, Archibald Cox tries to get access to these tapes. Nixon tries to deny him access to the tapes. I'm oversimplifying a bunch of things here. And when finally the courts saw, and Cox basically demand the actual tapes, and Nixon at one point wanted to get like a transcript or a summary, and Cox says, no, I want the actual tapes. Nixon goes to his Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and says, I want you to fire this guy. Richardson, who had pledged to Congress that he would not impede an investigation, refuses and resigns, goes to the number two guy in the Justice Department, William Ruckelshaus. Ruckelshaus also resigns rather than fire Archibald Cox. And then he goes to the number three person in the Justice Department, Robert Bork, who then goes on to fire Archibald Cox as the acting attorney general. And this sort of event is known as the Saturday Night Massacre because Nixon seems to be, you know, using his sort of executive authority to undermine this, what was supposed to be an independent investigation of the Watergate break-in and its connection to the White House.
Is that an apt, do you think it's an apt comparison? Because I've got some problems with it, actually.
I think it's... I'm curious what your objective... I mean, I think it's like all comparisons, you know, the historical analogy is... are always somewhat limited. What do you think are the big limitations of it?
Well, I think one of the big limitations on it is that the investigation into the Trump campaign has not yet reached the levels that the Watergate investigation had. I mean, by the time that Cox is removed, he's actually trying to. I think he issued a subpoena and wanted. He was demanding the tapes. And we haven't reached that point yet. Now, there are multiple investigations going on. It would be almost as if Nixon fired Archibald Cox immediately after he started working rather than getting to the point where the investigation was about to bear fruit. So I think that's a crucial difference. Although this is not to exonerate Trump. The other thing is, a really important difference is that although Elliot Richardson, Elliot Richardson is the Attorney General and William Ruckelshaus is his deputy, both resigned over this, whereas in various versions of this story this week and the justification for firing James Comey, Jeff Sessions, the current Attorney General, apparently agreed with this and in one version of it actually advised President Trump to remove Comey, although Trump later disavowed that notion. But the senior level of the Justice Department seems to be supporting this measure, and more or less saying it's a personnel matter within the Justice Department, we can do what we want. So I think the role of the Justice Department and the Attorney General is a crucial difference between what happened this week and what happened back in 1973. So I think that's an important difference. And as I said, the state of the the state of the investigation and the scandal, frankly. The other thing that protects President Trump for the time being, I think, and this is a key difference between today and 1973, is his support in Congress for the time being is still fairly solid, whereas Congress was turning against Nixon at that point. So I think the political environment was different. The administrative environment was slightly different in that when Richardson was ordered to fire Cox, he refused to do so, whereas Jeff Sessions may have been involved. One thing about Jeff Sessions that should be said is that he had met, and this has been established as a fact, he met improperly, possibly illegally, but certainly improperly, with the Russians during the transition period before President Trump was inaugurated. And as a consequence of that, recused himself when his nomination was approved by the Senate. He said he would have nothing to do with matters relating to Russia.
Yeah.
Yet the firing of Comey seems to be related, at least according to the president, to the Russia investigation.
Yeah.
So there's a problem there, I think, for Attorney General Sessions. So I think there are some differences.
Yeah. Well, I think the point about the sort of the timeline of this and the ways in which this is different from Watergate, I think, is important. Because I think people are often, you know, don't remember how long the Watergate process took to unfold. Thinking about, you know, the break-in happening in the summer, I guess, of 72, you know, Nixon not being removed until 70, not resigning until 74, and, you know, the Saturday Night Massacre happened in October, you know, but he's
still 73.
Of 73. So he has another 9 months in office afterwards. So we often think about the Saturday Night Massacre as being a turning point in the, you know, Nixon administration, the beginning of the end, but it's a very long end, you know, and it took a long time for the investigations to get up to the point where this happened, and a long time for it actually to sort of fully play itself out, ending in his resignation. So I think, you know, we often, I think especially when we teach this, we try to sort of, you know, contract this narrative into something we can tell students, and it sort of makes sense in a, you know, 40-minute lecture, but it actually was a very, very lengthy and detailed, you know, process that happened. The ways in which the timeline, which things unfold now, seems so radically different than the early 1970s to me. Who the hell knows what's going to happen?
Well, I think you're right. That was one of the points we began with today. But I think the rapidity of major events in the Trump administration, and they just follow one upon the other, and there are multiple stories to try to keep straight. It's very, very difficult to do. And you're right. The timeline for Watergate extended over this very lengthy period. Mm. And now maybe that means this is the equivalent of the Saturday Night Massacre, right, because events are happening so quickly that this is going to happen in 6 months, not 2 years. I don't know. And you and I have talked about, I think, listeners, we need to do an episode on Watergate. I don't think we're ready to do it yet, but I'm quite sure we're going to have the opportunity to do it in the future. Yeah. Because this scandal I think the Russia scandal is going to continue to unfold, or certainly the investigations are.
Well, there's two other things that are sort of Watergate related that seem to sort of pop up with this. One is that this week, one of the people that President Trump met with, for reasons that no one's entirely sure of, was Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
You know, and just this image of the two of them sitting together in the week that... And he has these weird tweets about, you know, hoping that Comey, there weren't recordings of Comey, there weren't tapes, you know, which seemed like, you know, very odd whether he would say that. Wondering whether that's a reference to his belief that he was bugged by the Obama administration, or whether he has tapes of various things. He seems very sort of Nixonian.
It does, and Nixonian was an adjective that was bandied about a lot this week, although the Nixon Library sent out a tweet saying, Richard Nixon never fired an FBI director. So once the Nixon Library thinks that you're harming their brand, you've got to wonder where you are. So it's, one thing to bear, well, I'd say two things in response to that, David. One is, for the benefit of our listeners who may not remember Watergate, and Watergate was 43 years ago. Mm. At least Nixon's resignation was 43 years ago. And so a significant, and I think that's important, a significant number of the people in the United States will have no memory of Watergate. And so, well, for people of a certain age, that's...
Well, I have no memory of Watergate, right. Frank. I mean, come on.
Well, I do. I was a very young child, but I was a precocious student of politics. But that's right. So the Watergate analogy may not resonate exactly as those of us who are historians or old or would think. But so with reference to Kissinger, Kissinger was a key figure in the Nixon administration. He wasn't directly implicated in Watergate. I think it's an odd choice. I also think meeting the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador who's at the center of
a... Well, he's not going to meet with G. Gordon Liddy. I mean, that would be pretty... Well, actually, nothing's on off the table, I guess.
Yeah, David, I would not make such a bold statement. I suppose there were odd residences, but I'm not sure Trump is necessarily aware of those. Do you think he is? I mean, he would have been in his early to mid-20s, I suppose, when Watergate unfolded.
Yeah, no, if he lived through that and didn't know that talking about tapes would sort of ring all these historical buttons and you know, meeting with Kissinger and all, if he didn't know that he was sort of playing into these tropes, I mean, was he stoned in his 20s? I mean, like, there's very few explanations that would make sense of him not being aware of the ways in which these things... He was sort of playing into those tropes.
Well, either he was doing, like, trolling on an incredibly sophisticated level.
Yes.
Or he really doesn't understand... Yeah. He needs to listen to this podcast because he doesn't understand American history.
If you are listening to this podcast, President Trump, please let us know, because we'd love to have you on the show. I hear you're going to visit the UK later this year. You know, you're coming up to Scotland. We're happy to, you know, we can even go to your mom's place, right? We can go and, you know.
Yeah, you're welcome. We would be delighted to interview you.
Yes. We'll buy you the Diet Cokes or whatever it is.
It would be huge. Right, David, all let's right. move on to the Health Care Act.
Yes, all right. A little bit over a week ago, the House of Representatives passed the American Health Care Act, which is supposed to be the repeal and replace for Obamacare.
Also called Trump Care 3 now.
Trump Care 3?
Well, I think
that... 2.5? I don't
know. Anyway, yeah, yes.
And this is sort of we have this meeting, sort of celebration in the Rose Garden, where Trump invited all of... the members, at least the Republicans in the House, to come and celebrate with him. What do you make of this as a legislative accomplishment?
Well, the first thing to say is it's no accomplishment at all yet. It was very odd that they held the celebration, although I'll say in a moment why I think they did so. It's an odd moment because they're only halfway there. As you know, and as many of our listeners will know, legislation has to pass both houses of Congress before the president can sign it into law. This bill, and just a reminder, it was a far more extreme version of the bill that failed to pass the House of Representatives. Well, they didn't even bring it to a vote about a month ago or 5 weeks ago. And so I think Trump, stung by the reports that his 100 days had produced very little, his first 100 days, really wanted to get this through the House of Representatives. I think the House of Representatives, at least the Freedom Caucus, which is the right wing of the Republican Party, so it's a right wing of a right wing party, which had committed itself for the past much of the past decade to repealing Obamacare, and repeal and replace was their mantra, really was desperate to do that.
Yeah,
and so they each had a kind of stake in this, which is why they passed it. But it still has to go to the Senate.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem as yet, it doesn't seem likely that the Republicans in the Senate, who seem to be a slightly more moderate group of people than those in the House of Representatives, are going to pass this. And because of the peculiar rules of the Senate, we talked about the filibuster a few weeks ago, it really can't pass the Senate probably likely without Democratic support. And there's no way the Democrats are going to support. So the bill as passed is not going to become law.
No.
So therefore, it was unclear what they were celebrating.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Trump did say this is a repeal and replace of Obamacare, which is factually not true. Obamacare is still the law of the land, you know, until this goes through the Senate and they reconcile the two different bills, which are going to be very, very different bills. And until Trump signs it, this is nothing. Right.
Well, it's not nothing. In fact, I think it's significant.
Well, it's significant, saying, yeah, but it's not actually law.
No, it is, you know, it is like holding a victory celebration at halftime of a football game.
Yes.
Whichever version of football you play. Exactly. Whatever version of football
There's
you play.
There's always halftime.
You don't celebrate at halftime.
Yeah.
And it's not entirely clear that they're even... Yeah, so it was a very strange moment. I think it betrayed the fact that President Trump doesn't understand the legislative process.
Yeah.
And this is where his experience, you know, we were told, oh, he's not of Washington. The fact he doesn't have experience is a good thing. We need somebody, you know, fresh to look at this, you know, come in and shake up the system. Maybe, but actually having somebody who understands the legislative process is a real bonus. President Obama wasn't that experienced as a legislator and had some difficulty. I mean, he had more experience than Trump, but he didn't get as much through Congress as he might have.
Yeah. But he understood at least how the process worked, I think, far more than Trump.
Yes, you see, I am not for a minute suggesting. I think President Obama had a far deeper understanding of the Constitution and the legislative process than President Trump. But what I'm saying is it's difficult even for people who do understand the process.
Yeah.
I don't think, based on the evidence we have before us, that President Trump understands the legislative process.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure he understands the Constitution and his own powers and the limits on those powers within the Constitution. And as a consequence of that, I think so. So I think he had a celebration because they passed what they said they wanted to pass. But he doesn't realize that this has to go to the Senate.
Well, I mean, a couple of things about the House bill I think are interesting. One is, you know, the speed at which they tried to sort of get this thing rammed through the House. You know, it didn't have a congressional budget office score, you know.
Explain what the score was, David.
Okay, so I want to say the Congressional Budget Office originates in the 1970s. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong about that. It's not my century. And the idea is basically to have it's an independent body, the Congressional Budget Office, that looks at legislation and adjudicate. It's basically a bunch of wonky economists.
It's nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan. They go and they look at the bill and they try to assess how much the legislation costs.
Essentially, game theory. They play it out. Not game theory. They game it out. They say, okay, if this is adopted,
what's
how much will it cost and who's it going to affect?
And what often happens is that they'll come out with a score and you know the Congressional Budget Office gets attacked by everybody. If you like the bill and they give you a score that you don't like, you say, oh, their numbers are unreliable. But this, both parties have done this, you know, for the past 30 years. What's interesting about this bill is they didn't even wait for the score to come out before they attacked the score. They just said, look, we're just not even going to care how much this costs. We're going to pass it. You know, this is a piece of legislation that's thousands of pages long. I don't think any human alive has actually read the whole bill. Or if they have and they're listening to this, I'm deeply sorry for you. It seems like marking exams or something. Because like,
And a number of congressmen who voted in favor of the bill admitted they hadn't read it.
And then other staffers, I mean, like, okay, congressmen don't read legislation. Cover your ears if this is going to be sensitive information to you guys. Congressmen usually actually don't read the legislation that they pass. They even don't read the legislation that they are sponsor. But usually they have a staff member read it and give them some summary of it. In this case, the version of the bill that passed, nobody read it. The final piece of legislation before it was voted on. The final amendments were introduced, I think, like the night before, you know, so we don't know how much this thing costs. We don't really know entirely what's in it. It's only now that it's gone through past the House that people have actually started to try to piece this thing apart and see if it makes any sense. And there's, like most enormous pieces of legislation, there are deeply contradictory elements within it. Passages, and just like the Obamacare bill, which was a sort of equally complex, although much more thoroughly vetted piece of legislation before it went through Congress. Even that has contradictory elements, and this seems to be a equally profoundly sort of...
So it wasn't thought through.
No. And there's clearly not like it. It's unclear exactly what this bill is supposed to do.
Right. It wasn't scored. It passed the House, but it's unlikely to become law.
Yes.
So why should we care?
I think it says something about the Republican. Well, I think it has lots of consequences. One, I think it says a lot about the Republicans in Congress that they're willing to sort of rush a piece of legislation through like this, and you know, with Trump's sort of rallying behind them, saying we need to have something on the books for my 100 days. Otherwise, I'm going to, you know, look like a total failure. He wouldn't phrase it that way. He said, you know, winning all the time, but clearly that's not the case. So I think it says something about their commitment to destroying Obamacare, that they would pass a piece of legislation that sort of takes a system that, you know, Obamacare, whatever one thinks about Obamacare, wasn't working as well as it possibly could, and just really sort of just breaking it and saying that here's what's left. You know, the fact that they're, you know, removing all these Medicaid provisions, it's a deeply troubling piece of legislation. And if you look at sort of the town halls that congressmen have been having in or not having, as the case may be, in the weeks since, I think that suggests there's sort of anger that lots of Americans have about this piece of legislation.
Well, if I may, I think that's the really significant portion. Yeah. So that display in the Rose Garden was a political statement.
Yeah.
And I think it was a statement, and it was a political statement that was intended for President Trump supporters and the kind of people who vote for the members of the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. Particularly in the Freedom Caucus. Now, we know from the analysis of the bill that's been carried out subsequently that those people may be among those most hurt by the bill, but we'll leave that aside for the time being. But that was a political statement. I think, however, they may come to regret that, and they may come to regret the images, you know, of cases of beer being brought into the House of Representatives when they were going to celebrate after their trip to the Rose Garden. The reason being, as you alluded
and
to...
And they're drinking Bud Light, which is crappy beer.
Yeah, I mean, yes, exactly, but that's a... Thank you for noting that, David. There goes a sponsorship with Bud Light.
we are a classy show.
We wouldn't take it.
Yeah, exactly.
However, as you suggested, the congressmen have gone home and they've been holding town meetings in their districts or, in some cases, canceling town meetings in their districts. But what's happened is there's been an incredible amount of opposition to this bill expressed by common citizens. And the men and women who voted for the bill have been subject to a great deal of public pushback from their constituents. I think this is important in two ways. Excuse me, both in looking backwards and looking forward. Looking backwards, it's reminiscent of the summer of, I think it was 2010, when Democratic congressmen and women were subject to that kind of opposition and criticism by their constituents. And that was the moment that gave birth to the Tea Party.
Yeah.
And the Tea Party certainly dragged the Republican Party to the right. Now, it was a long-standing trend that goes back decades, but they really, you know, it was a swerve to the right, thanks to the Tea Party. The Tea Party took over the Republican Party to some extent and gave us Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we may be seeing, and I say may, the emergence of an equivalent movement on the left in response to the repeal of Obamacare.
Mm.
And, hang on, I also think it may be germane in terms of looking forward back to our first topic. If Donald Trump is going to be impeached, and one reason the Watergate analogy keeps coming up is because it's premised on an assumption that the president might be impeached over illegalities associated with the Russian affair and the investigation thereof. If he's going to be impeached, he can only be impeached if the House of Representatives votes for articles of impeachment. As things presently stand, that is
not going to happen.
Highly unlikely or impossible because the House is controlled by Republicans and very conservative Republicans at that. However, I think one of two things could happen that could lead to impeachment. One would be that those congressmen start to feel pressure in their districts and are worried about losing their seats.
Hmm.
And so some of them may separate from the president over that. The other is they actually lose their seats and are replaced by Democrats. The Cook Political Report, which is a kind of respectable political publication, is estimating at the moment that they're saying there's a 50-50 chance the Democrats retake the House of Representatives in the elections next year. If that happens, I think Donald Trump's in big trouble.
Yeah.
And that could happen not necessarily over the firing of James Comey, but over legislation like this bill. Mm. So I think there is a connection between these two things. I cut you off a minute ago.
Thinking about these town halls, the extent to which they're happening, and I think lots of the Republican congressmen are just deciding not to do them. I think they're actually different than the Tea Party from 7 years ago. And I think in an important respect is they don't seem as people going to them don't seem as ideological as the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party, in its opposition to Obama and opposition to Obamacare, rooted its opposition in a sort of in lots of things, but I think that part of their opposition that they framed it in ideological terms about the power of the federal government and individual liberty and freedom and America and other kinds of nonsense. The reading I'm getting of the town halls that are happening now are often people who are not political activists, but are people who are saying, I've got a child with a pre-existing condition. Will we lose our health care? You know, and it's much more, the people who are challenging congressmen and raising this ruckus aren't doing it from a sort of a political ideological perspective as they are doing it from really a sincere concern for their personal welfare and the welfare of their family members. I mean, I think this whole, you know, stuff with getting rid of Obamacare's protections for pre-existing conditions and other things is, you know, I think pushing people into the political, you know, to act politically that had previously not acted politically, including some people who had been Trump supporters who were saying, you know, that like this is what I thought I was going to get, and here I'm finding I might be losing my health care or not getting the same health care I was going to have.
But don't you think that actually makes the opposition
I think that's
more potent.
Oh, to be sure.
And powerful.
Very potentially, yes. You know, I think because if these are the swing voters, the mythical swing voters, which I'm always, you know, people are looking for them. I'm not sure they always exist, but if they do exist, I think these are them.
I mean, the news reports are incredibly powerful when somebody stands up and says, look, your bill's going to kill me.
Yes.
Or my daughter or what have you. I mean, that's very powerful and seems less, that seems, it's very, very powerful and more effective than specious claims about death panels that we heard 70 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
And those were effective.
Yes, to be sure. So, right.
Well, we shall see.
See, yes.
We shall see. I think in something you and I have discussed in preparation for this episode, I have a feeling we're going to be returning both to Watergate
yes.
and to healthcare, the history of healthcare in the United States, possibly in dedicated special episodes.
Yes, yes. Special episodes on the way. All right, time for our last drops. What do you got, Frank?
I want to recommend a podcast. As you said earlier, I just returned from a wonderful conference in Ireland. And while in Ireland, I met a guy whose podcast I admire a lot, Patrick Gagan, who's a professor at Trinity College Dublin. And Patrick's a very, very impressive historian and a very, very active public intellectual in Ireland. He has a podcast called, well, he has a radio program called Talking History that's available as a podcast. It's on News Talk in Dublin on from Sundays from 7 to 8 p.m. So if you're in Dublin or you have a radio app on your phone, you could listen to it live, but the podcast is available. It's different from what we do in the sense that we're interpreting contemporary events through a kind of historical lens and providing context. And what Patrick tends to do is to interview fellow historians about any number of matters. And so he's recently had episodes on the Battle of Agincourt and the Silk Road and the Irish Revolution in Cork and things like that. And so he's wide-ranging in terms of people he interviews. But I can, if you haven't heard it, David, I would
recommend. I haven't. I'll have to put that in my queue.
Yeah, so definitely put it in your queue. And after you listen to The Whiskey Rebellion, you should give Talking History a chance every week. Cool. What about you, David? What's your last drop?
So we're in the middle of exam season, which means I just finished a huge pile of marking, and I'm about to get another big, huge pile of marking tomorrow, which I'm looking forward to. Students, if you're listening to this, I am very much looking forward to reading your essays. I'm going to. Anyway. Which means my brain is kind of mush at the end of the day. My ability to sort of form coherent sentences, if it isn't already clear, is somewhat limited. And so often during exam season, I go and sort of reread things I've already read or you know, something sort of to cleanse the palate after reading, you know, 50 essays on the strengths and weaknesses of the New Deal. And so I've been reading two novels sort of simultaneously that have both actually been in the news recently, both novels I've read in the past, but I thought it was a good excuse to reread them. One is Neil Gaiman's American Gods, which I guess is being currently a television series on Stars, and I think it's on available on Amazon Prime or something. But I read the book many years ago when it first came out, and I'm sort of rereading it now.
What's it about?
So I don't want to spoil too much for those people who've watched this show, but the basic premise, it's kind of a American road travel novel, but part of the premise is that the gods of antiquity are living in America, but their power is greatly diminished because their power is in some ways correlated to the degree to which they are still worshipped.
Oh, right.
And so it's about sort of the old gods and new gods in America. And there's lots of, you know, good sort of traveling around real America, as it were. And the other book, which is also kind of a weird philosophical America road trip novel, Zen, the Art of Motorcycle Maidens by Robert Persig, who passed away, I guess, just about a week ago. And that's always been one of my favorite novels, and it's sort of good to sort of revisit favorite old works, and especially, you know, places that... The thing that I like about both of these pieces, they feel very much situated in particular places, and you feel like sort of the texture of what it is to sort of travel the road in America, which is something I always like to do. So a good sort of palate cleanser and exam diets. But if people haven't read either novel, I highly recommend both American Gods and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maidens.
Excellent. And then when you're not reading, you can listen to Talking History.
Excellent. All right.
All right. Cheers, David.
Cheers.